This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and it started, folks.
Leave the house at 6 o'clock to be on time.
Monday morning, brand new year, back to the grind.
Leave the wife and kids at home to make a dime.
How many hours are you going to put in today? Count them. Someone is.
Grab your lunch pail, check for mail in your slot. You won't get your check if you don't punch the clock. Bus rider.
Whether or not a bus gets you to work today, punching a clock generally means getting your 8 hours. The 8-hour workday, which we design our days and weeks around, is a century old. Henry Ford's idea of strict clockwork organization for his industrial workforce turned 100 yesterday. Elizabeth Cohen is professor of history at Harvard University and dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. She says Ford's 8-hour, 5-buck-a-day idea was a piece of radical social engineering that is still playing out in the U.S. economy.
We have to see the $5 day, the 8-hour work day, in the context of a struggle over power in the workplace. Henry Ford had this notion of creating the Model T, which he implemented in 1908, that would be a huge sales item. But what he needed to do that was a growing and secure labor force. And what he was faced with was a huge amount of absenteeism, a huge amount of turnover. And at the same time, and this is very important to remember, he had to figure out a strategy for really making the assembly line production process work.
Well, let me just ask. I mean, did Ford run the numbers in some sense, in the sense that he said, all right, if my workers and the industrial workers who are part of my competition all behaved in this way, we might see these economic consequences in terms of leisure time, disposable income, those sorts of things? Or did these things just sort of happen?
What you have to realize is that it wasn't just $5 for every day. Basically, it was divided into two parts. Half of it was a wage that every worker got. The other half was what was considered profit sharing. At the same time that the $5 day went in, so was created something called the sociological department, which went into workers' homes and observed if they were, in fact, practicing good behavior at home. Were they thrifty? Did they avoid drinking? So you only got the profit sharing half every 2 weeks if, in fact, you lived up to those expectations.
Let's talk a little bit about the creation, because of the $5 a day wage, of a middle class with enough disposable income to actually buy Ford products.
I do think that the $5 day inaugurated a very important dimension of 20th century capitalism that really prevailed until the Great Recessions of the 1970s. And that is to think about workers as consumers as well as producers. So in the 1920s, there were efforts to encourage mass consumption. Here it was mostly middle-class consumers who were given incentives through installment buying and so forth. The 1930s, Roosevelt and the New Dealers recognized that increasing aggregate demand was going to be the best way out of the Great Depression. And they did that. The war only encouraged that in terms of the kinds of savings that people were able to have after, you know, a decade of depression. And then when the war ended, they went, you know, out into the marketplace with great enthusiasm to spend those savings. So today, we are still very dependent on consumption for our economy. But when somebody goes to buy, you go and you look for the cheapest price you can find for the sake of getting a cheap price, not to keep your neighbor employed. It's very, very different notion of what prosperity means.
Elizabeth Cohen is professor of history at Harvard University and dean of the Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. Elizabeth, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. So in this battle between employers and workers, what's the scorecard look like from where you sit? I mean, can you afford what it is that you produce, as Henry Ford's workers suddenly could with an 8-hour workday and a $5-a-day wage? 100 years after the 40-hour work week, how's your productivity even measured? How do you track your work hours? And are you compensated? How are you compensated for the time you put in?
My name is Christy Davis. I'm calling from Martinez, California. My company requires that we keep a timesheet that all of us fill out. I work with several officers a day. Plus, any vacation hours or sick time or anything like that is all tracked via computer from my boss.
Timesheets, very familiar to most workers these days. Lots of you out there. From Augusta, South Carolina, I'm salaried, but still have to track all of my time in three different timesheet systems for billing purposes. I hate it. Hate it more than the time clock, punching the clock. A lot of bureaucracy there. From some of you who work much more than it appears on any timesheet here in McKinney, Texas, I am not tracked after 40 hours and not compensated for any time worked over that. How about Fort Lauderdale, Florida? Compensated, I'm a salaried retail manager. Hourly workers are not permitted overtime. Guess who picks up the slack? I work 6 days a week, most of them well over 9 hours a day. When we question this, we are told we're lucky we have jobs. Sounds like the pre-Henry Ford era there. Eugene, Oregon, I'm a first-year kindergarten teacher. I get compensated for 4 hours a day. I put in twice that. Plus, nearly every waking hour, planning, organizing, and searching for ways to improve myself and my students, I'm compensated by a sense of purpose and delight in spending my time with 32 tiny people. That's a fairly large class size, even for Eugene, Oregon. So is your wage symbolic? Is your compensation much more than mere money? Many of you who work for yourselves face challenges like dealing with the clock and calculating pay.
This is Desi in South Carolina. Since I work for myself, I don't actually keep track of my hours, and pretty much all the money I do make is put straight back into the business.
Shannon in Locust Grove, Oklahoma. I've been a motorcycle mechanic since 1982. The work has become so devalued that I earned just over 13 grand last year, about half of what I earned the very first year for the same 50 to 60 hours.
Ouch, from Locust Grove, Oklahoma. That really hurts. But the business owner before that from South Carolina, you work all the time. It's 24/7. As the owner of my business, this is someone from Reading, Pennsylvania, I get what's left after the other overhead. I don't track my hours. I might get too depressed. Writers feel that way. From Florida, I used to write down the hours that I worked because I work per diem at different faculties, but I've stopped and just trust that I will be compensated for the exact hours that I work. I do keep a weekly running tab in my head, so I have an idea of how many hours I work, just in case. You know, Florida, I think I might audit your hours a little bit more. It might make a little more sense. A couple of you out there feel great about the time you put in and forget about money.
Hi, my name is Nadia. I'm calling from Brooklyn. I work for a labor union, and every 2 weeks, we get an additional 2 days into our vacation time. And also, if we work more than 35 hours per week, all of those hours go into our vacation time as well. So right now, I have about maybe 49 days of vacation, which is great.
Martina Moss, and I'm calling from Oakland, California. I am one of those lucky people that have a job they love. I get to be part of making a life-saving medicine. I have regular work hours, but my phone is always on. I work whenever I'm needed, and I don't mind at all.
So Nadia's got lots of vacation, and Martina there from Oakland loves her job. Tell us about your work week. How many hours do you put in? How are those hours measured? And how are you compensated? How does it break down, money versus satisfaction? Share your story at 877-8MY-TAKE or at thetakeaway.org. Coming up in a moment, more on work and whether this 40-hour work week idea is really more of a fiction, depending on where you are in the workforce. Stay with us. This is The Takeaway. You know, if the 8-hour day was the radical idea of work a century ago, what's the radical idea today? 8 hours might sound radical to those of you working multiple jobs in multiple income households. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org and tell us how your work is measured. Clock, timesheets, billable hours, honor system, whatever it is, just give us an idea of how you track the work you do. These days, some sectors of the workforce are embracing radically flexible ideas of where and when to work, while some tech companies like Yahoo are trying to rein all that in, while other professions expect you to work all the time, and you know who you are. From Medford, Oregon, one of you writes, I punch or slide the clock. I work at one of those legacy jobs that we are fighting so hard to keep. time and a half for over 8 or over 40. Joining us now is Pamela Hines, Associate Professor of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford University. Pamela, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Pamela, your colleague Elizabeth Cohen at Harvard says that with his 8-hour day, Ford started a revolution between employers and workers. From your perspective as a co-director for the Center for Work Technology and Organization there at Stanford, are workers winning or losing the battle in 2014? And are number of hours worked even a meaningful measure of anything anymore?
So most of the workers that I study are professionals, and I would say that very, very few of them are working only 8 hours a day or only 40 hours a week. It's hard to say whether they are winning or losing. You know, it's interesting to hear some of the callers earlier saying, you know, like the teacher from Oregon saying that she, you know, has a sense of purpose in her job, the woman who is making life-saving medicine and loves that. You know, we also see that in the workers that we're studying. It's a balance between, you know, really having a sense of purpose in the work that they're doing and also trying to have some kind of work-life balance.
You know, Henry Ford, of course, invented the assembly line where the jobs were very chain-oriented and, you know, narrowly structured. I mean, you didn't really see the big picture in producing the car. I'm wondering if in a service economy, it's easier to find that sense of satisfaction in certain sectors. It's easier to sort of define your job according to your personality and still remain productive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, certainly among the workers that we study, there's a lot more autonomy. People are making a lot more decisions about how to approach their job, what to do in their jobs. A lot of the workers that I study are globally distributed. So they're working with people in India, in China, you know, in other parts of the globe. And there's a real sense of satisfaction and learning. You know, what we hear a lot about is people love sort of stretching themselves and learning new things and learning about new cultures and traveling, and that brings a real sense of satisfaction.
So technology drove the industrial economy at the turn of the 20th century, and the consensus was, I think, socially, was that technology in the workplace was, on balance, dehumanizing. Would you say the technology being used in the workplace today in the growth sectors of the economy that you study is dehumanizing or more humanizing?
Well, you know, it's a combination of both. You know, on one hand, all of the new communication technologies, you know, with email and video conferencing and knowledge management systems or shared document repositories and all of that enables people to work with a lot more people at a distance. They don't have to be at their desks to do it. So in that sense, it allows a lot more flexibility. On the other hand, it disconnects people from one another in some sense. I think there's a bit of overconfidence that we can actually work effectively with people over these technologies. And we tend to forget how much interaction with our colleagues and how much work actually happens outside of meetings and depends heavily on trust and familiarity with the people with whom we're working.
And that was, of course, the Yahoo argument for trying to rein in flex time to a certain extent. I'm wondering what impact, and again, I know you don't have numbers on this, but what impact technology has on workers who know they're being watched, who maybe are coming increasingly aware of the fact that all of their communications are essentially corporate property on some level.
Yeah, you know, among the people that I study, you know, we do a lot of field studies. Mostly, as I said, we study professionals. So that would be engineers, product designers, architects, and so forth. And I think there's an awareness that they are or could be watched. But I don't think that it has a big effect on people's daily work activities.
So it's not a Big Brother sense. It's really just sort of an element of the cost of doing business, like, you know, bad coffee comes from the machine a generation ago. It's not something that causes a great deal of anxiety.
Yeah, not that I do not sense that it does.
What about the issue of flexibility and flex time? Do people really have this flexibility, or is it something that companies tend to regulate much more?
So that's a really interesting question. They do. They actually have a tremendous amount of flexibility, and the idea is that people can go do their grocery shopping or get their hair cut in the middle of the day, but then they also may need to be up on a conference call at 6 a.m. With India, or up until 10 or 11 p.m. with China. The reality, though, is that most workers don't take advantage of that flexibility. Mm. What we see is that they're still at work during the middle of the workday, as well as working much earlier and much later. And part of the challenge is that they're collaborating, say, with people in India and China, but they're also collaborating with people locally who are working during that traditional 8-hour workday. So if you're going to collaborate with people during the same time that they're working, you really need to span a very large number of hours.
Sounds like an epitaph for the 8-hour day. I wonder if Henry Ford would think of it as backsliding if he were alive today, or some kind of a brave new world. Pamela Hines, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pamela Hines is professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University, where she also co-directs the Center for Work, Technology, and Organization.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.